Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA, to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
All right, Entree Architect community, it's time for context and clarity. The reason that I come to you every day is so that we can find clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect. And it doesn't matter if you're the employee of a firm, maybe you dream of starting your own firm. Maybe you even said 2021 is my year and you're on the runway to starting your own firm. Maybe you've had a firm for a year or 10 years or 20 years and you're starting to rethink, reimagine what your firm could or should be. All of the topics that we cover, one topic every day, fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture, and they are the need-to-know topics for the success of architects just like you. You know, after every episode of Context and Clarity, I ask you to find some time to breathe and relax and maybe find a way to rejuvenate. And that's exactly what we're doing at Context and Clarity right now. It's the holidays, and Catherine and I and the whole Context and Clarity team, we're taking a break right now. But I didn't want you to be without Context and Clarity Live, so I thought maybe I would share with you one of my favorites from the first 45 episodes of Context and Clarity Live. This one is Jonathan Siegel. It's one of the most anticipated episodes, and it stands to reason. This idea of architect as developer is one of the most romanticized, one of the most popular ideas in the small architect community. And having Jonathan Siegel, probably the first most known person to talk about and to develop the architect as developer courses, somebody that's been doing the architect as developer model for 33 years, his entire career, it's all he's ever done, right? Having Jonathan join us for Context and Clarity Live was a great thing. It was a great conversation. And, you know, I'll say it's fitting because at times you can hear construction going on around him. And that's his life, right? That's what he is immersed in. So I hope that you enjoy the sounds of construction. I hope that you enjoy the conversation. And I just want to say thank you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being part of this community. And we'll be back here again very soon. Jonathan Siegel, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you here today. Like I said, architect as developer is a really popular topic. There may be some romanticized versions out there in people's heads, but obviously with people like you in the profession and the course that you teach and everything else, it's a very real thing. So one of the things I'm curious about, you know, a lot of times we talk about professional backstories, but I think with you, this goes all the way back to when you were in school, doesn't it?
I always kind of wanted to do my own thing. Actually, in the beginning, I wanted to do my own architectural company. And my world has been pretty much serendipity ever since I was a young kid. And things just happen. I don't, you know, really plan that much, even though I do try to plan. You know, got out of school, got to San Diego, was going to work for two firms for 2 years each, a big one and a small one. And then was on a board of directors downtown in San Diego called the Center City Development Corporation's Residence Advisory Committee, and met a guy that was doing a project. And I said, hey, would you please look at my thesis project that I did in school, because I'd like to do some row houses downtown. And this guy, Charles, said to me, You know, he's actually pretty mean. He said, you know, don't be an idiot. You don't want to be an architect. You want to be a developer. Develop your own project. And the rest is sort of history. His mother had a lot of land, had no money. And he said, buy this property for $50 a square foot. It was about a 7,500 square foot triangular lot. And I'll give you 6 months, you know, to close. And then it just sort of took off from there. And that was really good. And then we built 7 row houses and the whole economy just took a dump. And that was like 91, 90 that it took that dump. And we made $500,000 the first year in profit. And then the next year we made $35,000. So it's, you know, it's an interesting program. Now, you know, everything's more consistent. We got out of for sale housing into for rent housing. We were a little bit ahead of the curve on that. And it's made for a pretty stable lifestyle.
Well, that's good. But how did you, so you meet Charles and his mom has some property and you get into this. How did you learn it? I mean, it sounds like maybe it's trial by fire, but how did you learn how to do the development side of everything?
Well, you know, let's back up and say, you know, what does it take to put a building together? It takes someone with a piece of land, it takes someone to do a drawing, someone to understand a product type. And then someone to build it. And if you start thinking about the skill set that the architects have, they don't have the piece of land, but you can acquire that. All the other skill sets all of us architects have. We understand the product type. We understand to research it if we don't. We understand how to do a set of drawings. And we understand, you know, what comes in front of the next piece to build a building. So the key to success is really to do your research and to do, you know, small baby steps and grow slowly and incrementally. You'll make a lot of mistakes, but if you can make them small enough, you can correct those mistakes and then you can capitalize on them. So if you develop something that you really wanted to have certain rooms a little bit taller, a little bit bigger, you can always change that. But if you offer that idea to the owner per se, they're going to benefit from it and you're not going to get any monetary gain on that. So by controlling all the parts and actually owning the product when you're done, you will capitalize on all of your hard work. And as most architects know, you know, we tend to put in more hours than we build. And we tend to go much further out to make something better than any of the other people in the triangle being, you know, the owner, the architect, and the contractor. We don't like that triangle. We like the round circle with everybody in the middle. That's the owner, that's me, the architect, that's me, and the contractor, that's me. So when we're all here, we're all happy with each other. We're all giving the big group hug. And we're all liking each other, right? No one's screaming, no one's writing threatening letters and stuff. But whereas you have that triangle, you know, there's the owner and the contractor, you know, they make nice, you make nice, you make nice in the beginning, and then the architect then slowly is getting cheated on and divorced to where the owner comes over and starts talking to the contractor here, and then they get all married up and they hate you now because you're making all the mistakes, or so the contractor is telling the owner this. And then the owner isn't liking the delays, the owners into liking the change orders. So this is not synergetic. It's problematic. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. No one has the same vested interest in that triangle. And granted, it does work out, but in my world, it's never been the case. There's always been these people pulling and pointing fingers and so forth. So that's the brief explanation to
that. So why aren't more architects doing what you do? Why aren't more architects operating as developers as well?
I think there's a fear. I mean, if you really look at it, it is general math. There's nothing magic about it. You know, you got to put your head down and keep every morning you wake up, there's that big ball in front of you. You got to keep pushing it. You have to have perseverance. I just don't think the architects know the program. As we discussed, I have an online course that basically outlines, you know, from the beginning to the end, how to do everything and gives you all the contracts and all the documents to go through and utilize. It really is a basic process. It's all about decisions. So, you know, if you have sort of like two things, bad information creates a bad decision. You know, good information will help you create a good decision. But you got to make the right decisions. If you can't make good decisions, it's not going to work out for you because you'll be hit and barraged by just massive amounts of bad news and problems that you have to wade through. And if you can make proper decisions along the way, it'll work out, and it works out well. And then hopefully you'll create a better city, a better environment, a better wherever you're working out of that everybody will benefit from. And hopefully then you'll get some recognition. Maybe you get published and maybe you get some awards. And then finally, hopefully, you know, there's a financial thing that happens at the end and that works out pretty well for you.
For anybody out there that wants to know more about the online course or courses, actually, that Jonathan was just talking about, go to architectasdeveloper.com and you'll find all the information there about the variety of courses that Jonathan has developed over the years to help out with this. We've got a comment here, Mandy. What's this?
So Mark asks, what's the scariest situation you've ever found yourself in as a developer, and how did you work it out?
Well, there's so many of them. I can try and be part of a recent one. And that was, we tried to hire subcontractors that are of our scale. So the analogy would be, if you ever, you know, want to get in spar in a boxing match, you don't want to go against a heavyweight. And obviously, if you're a heavyweight, you want to go against a smaller lightweight. Well, we had a subcontractor that was electrical contractor. And we had three bidders. He was the low bidder, magic, isn't it? So we took the low bidder, and he was a large company, did about $180 million worth of electrical work. And it was so poorly managed. It was unbelievable. They had three different layers of on-site manager, wasn't really on-site, but let's say the daily manager, then a manager of him, then a manager of that guy. And, you know, there was this whole process they had to go through because they were used to some large jobs. Don't know why they took ours. Ours was a million one, I think, was the job size. And they just messed up, completely messed up. So when the day was done, in their world, they had a spreadsheet that showed they'd spent $1.5 million or $1.6 million in costs. Who knows what costs are and what's real and so forth. And these guys aren't the kind of guys that we're in the boxing ring, you know, hey, you know, we're not going to sue each other. We just want to work something out. And I always profess, do not ever sue anybody. Always work something out, no matter how painful it is, because it's going to be just, it's going to save years of your life and a lot of your money. So the guy, we paid him in full, this $1.1 million. And then he leaned us for another $1 million. Well, my contract was for $1.1 million. You can't just lean me just because you want to for another $1 million. And he basically, excuse the language, said, fuck you. I'm big. I just go send this over to in-house legal. And we start the ball rolling. And I'm looking at this and I'm trying to get my permanent financing. I've got this lien. So long and short is I have a very good friend that's one of the presidents over Turner Construction. He knows this guy personally. He helped me work it out and mediate this thing before it got real ugly. And I ended up paying an extra couple $100,000 over his $1.1 million contract. Well, the funny thing is, of the couple hundred I paid him, 100 was real legit and the other one wasn't. So let's say I paid 100 more than I should have, but the next bidder was $500,000 more. So effectively it all worked out, but the pain and suffering that goes through, it tends to be pretty brutal. And this is the kind of thing where you can't shrivel up and go into a ball. You have to stand up, push that ball, and move forward. But we've had a building burn down. I don't want to tell you what we haven't had because I don't want it to happen. But we never had an earthquake happen during one of our buildings. But I do buy earthquake insurance during the course of construction, specifically for that situation. So the other sort of thing to remember here is, you know, in insurance, you can never buy enough and you should never use it. Because you use it and they're going to take it away, or they're going to make it way more expensive. But over-insure yourself at every situation. Stop eating before you get rid of your E&O or your general liability insurance. I know I'm kind of drifting all over, but there are some other crazy things that have happened. Buildings burning down during the course of construction. When we had a project, we have a house in Idaho where I went to school, University of Idaho in Moscow. We have a house in McCall. And we went there for Christmas. This was back in 98. We came back down and one of the investors in this deal, this apartment deal, says, hey, did you see all the fireworks? And, you know, haha, that's kind of funny. He goes, no, check it out. Look at the TV. So we put the 11 o'clock news on and one portion of our building was caught on fire by a homeless guy that had his Bunsen burner in there. and the Bunsen burner just torched down basically, what was it, 8 of the 32 units. So immediately I had to go get the insurance in line, take care of all this stuff. We rebuilt the building, and then when we rebuilt it, somehow waterproofing wasn't done properly by the general contractor. That's when we had general contractors. And the whole building leaked. So then I went for my first party insurance, and the first party insurance during the actual use of the building basically paid $500,000 out, and then it stopped. They said, we're not paying anymore. We believe this is a defect issue. You know, go after yourself and you're out. So then I took on 2 high power attorneys in LA without an attorney because I didn't want to spend the money. And we went through an arbitration process, a mediation process, and basically stuffed these guys. And I got another $500,000 on that. But that was kind of a crazy turn of events. Again, this stuff is basic stuff. And if you can kind of think properly, you can do most, if not all of it yourself. I don't suggest you take on a couple attorneys out of LA, but it's strange how I actually knew more than they did in their craft. And the mediator was just so sick of me. I'm just beating these guys up. He just said, Uncle, I'm out. Get the hell out of here. Write this guy a check. And it worked out. It worked out for us. So I'll think of more anecdotal things too.
You just said that you don't have general contractors anymore. How does that work now? Are you self-performing that piece of it?
Yeah, we had, there's another situation. We had back in 2000, we had a general contractor that absolutely had to get their name on downtown. Downtown was just starting to happen. We had a 45-unit project that we were doing. His name was John Wayne, John Wayne Construction. And I'm telling you, there must have been 30 banners around this property. It was a 25,000-square-foot lot, and he had basically underbid the project. And at that point, we're just going, we don't need these losers anymore. It's unbelievable how they put their hand out. You do all the work, and they get the fees and so forth. And so he walked off the job, and he put a bonded stop notice. You can put a stop notice down, which basically says, I'm stopping work. The bank gets all twisted up. But when there's a bonded stop notice, the bank by law has to stop distributing funds. So I didn't have a whole bunch of money. I think I had $100,000 in the bank. I sold 3 cars, sold a building, and raised a whole bunch of money. So I kept the project going. And these guys eventually went back to mediation because you don't want to sue anybody. And the mediator just handed them, you know, their head. And we got $250,000 out of those guys. And they walked off the job. And that was it. That was the end. We no longer want general contractors. My theory was if you draw it, you build it. So at that point, we had maybe 4 or 5 people in the office, and we had a couple projects going, different phases and so forth. And they would go out and they'd be the superintendent. I mean, if you draw the drawings, you know where it is. I can't imagine having a project, a complicated project, not that ours are complicated, but a real complicated project. And you come in and you have to basically start reading a book, memorizing what page all these, you know, pieces of information on, and build a building. But if you draw it, it's pretty simple for you. And then you can pare down your drawings. Our drawings don't have any specifications in them. All the specifications are actually in the contracts with the subcontractors. The subcontractors now indemnify us, the architects and the owners. So when something happens, you're protected. You're not protecting someone else. It just is kind of like, everything kind of gets real smaller and tighter and lovelier. And instead of blowing up and getting larger and more complicated, there's no job directors, no RFIs, no hate mail, no delays. It's just a different way to do it. I'm not saying you can do every project like this, but it's certainly a different way of looking at doing architecture. And it's worked out extremely well for us. I just got sued for the first time in 30 years. It's a frivolous lawsuit, and it was because the window the installer didn't do his job right, and some water got in, and then a tenant sued. But we've been pretty much lawsuit-free for 30-some years. We've had things like this lien that we worked out. It's always better to eat it and write a check than it isn't. I'll give you another quick, for instance. And I'm drifting a little bit here, but we had a situation where a property owner sold us a property. It's called Mr. Robinson. The property next door. He owned the property next door. He sold this property. We developed the building. We went through and scraped the whole property. As we went down another foot, we found that his sewer line was running across our property to the street. So I immediately went to the, and it broke. So I called him, hey, you need to route this around the property. I immediately went to the city and said, is it okay in the code to allow someone else's sewer line to run across our property and get into the public right away? And the answer, long-winded, was not really, but we'll work with you on it. And this guy, on the other hand, ran to his attorneys and then decided to try and sue us, saying that we, you know, ran over his sewer line, which was incorrect because his sewer line was on our property. The long and story in short is we took him to mediation, and we basically got two parking spaces off his property, and he wrote us a $250,000 check for the problem. But it's just working through it, making proper decisions. I moved transformers. I knew going in that somehow he's going to always have this sewer line. So I routed it around. I redesigned the building during the construction to do that. But if that was, you know, a regular thing with an architect and an engineer and all the other people, it seems like that would end up in a lawsuit. The project would have stopped. I didn't want it. I kept feeding it with the money to keep going. The bank had confidence in what we did, and we got through it. So that's long-winded, but some anecdotal tidbits.
It's a good story. Like an amazing story, actually.
There's a lot of them. You wouldn't believe them.
Manny, it looks like we've got something from Michelle here.
Yeah, so just segue, you're talking about money. Michelle, well, I don't, you know Michelle Hoddle, right? Down in San Diego.
Yep.
Yeah. So she's saying hi to you, and she's excited to see you on here. But she actually had a question for you. How do you get the money to develop? And would you recommend getting independent investors first or trying to finance it yourself?
Depends what you're doing. I think it's really important you start small. So small would be doing your own house. That typically takes 20 to 30% down. If you're doing a larger project, obviously you need more money. At some point, so I've struggled with this. You know, we could have scaled up our company and probably had two or three times the amount of units and so forth. But if the investors own half the units, you really don't have two or three times. You have half of that, and half of that's what we have. So in the beginning, build your own house. You should be able to do your sweat equity. I call it Johnny Bucks. With the architectural fees that you're going to get, with the general contractor's fees, with the superintendent fees, you may be doing some of the sub trades yourself, framing, what have you. Start small, build your house, and then maybe go to friends and family and ask for some funds. You want to make sure that those people don't have any ownership of what you're doing, though. You're just borrowing money, you're going to pay it back. And that may take a personal guarantee. But the last thing you want to do is give away your talent to these people and let them prosper from all the good decisions you're going to make. That's going to make your building more effective, more financially effective, and less expensive to build. It's a problem the way I do it versus the typical fee developer will just be going in there and all they want to do is make fees. They're never going to own any building because they're never going to be able to recover because the preferred return to the investors is going to eat up all the profits such that you'll never pay down that unless you sell the building but you get any funds. It's more important that you do your house, do a 4-unit project, get rental income, lever up into a 6-unit, 8-unit, 10-unit. Maybe you can even sell the smaller ones and then 1031 exchange into larger ones. But you'd be surprised how it sort of works. We got up to 250 units again. We sold, I think, 70 units for $45 million last year. And we paid the government a little bit of money, too. I bought some bombs and some fuel and stuff like that for the military. But you know what? It still was, you know, in the 30% tax category versus 50 because of the capital gains versus ordinary income. And I'm glad to take little money off the table and pay a little tax rather than continuing to lever in and lever in and lever in. You know, you got to the pigs get fat, but the hogs get slaughtered. No profit's a bad profit. No loss is a good loss. Just try to slowly take baby steps to get where you are. And then hopefully you won't get hurt.
It seems like and sort of a foundational theme to all of this, though, is going back to the idea of the architect actually getting paid for their talents, I think is how you said it a minute ago.
Right.
And that's really what you're leveraging here, isn't it?
When you say leveraging, remember in the scheme of things, about 17% of the cost of a building is in fees that you can potentially get yourself, not including, let's say, a developer fee, because some banks don't look at it that way. They want to wipe that fee out. So if you can take a 35%, if it's cost $100, $35 has to come out of your pocket, and the bank's going to loan you $65. Of the $35, about half of that can be fees. So if you can keep your day job and do this on the side, when I mean day job, it could be your own architectural firm or working for somebody or doing something else while you're building your first house, which, as I see a comment here, the banks are more than happy to lend you on that. And they'll lend you the better money than I get. They'll lend you money that says, here's construction money. And when you're done with construction, we'll lock you in before you even start construction on your permanent financing. So I know today I can start a house, and then 12 months when I'm done, I could care less where the interest rates are at because I've already locked it in going 10 years forward. When I do my buildings, I go on to get a construction loan. The construction loan's done, then I got to get permanent lending. So back to the general question you asked, about half of the money that you actually need is your fee that you can defer. So if you can live without those fees, then you can defer them. So instead of taking that $17, and let's say you're in the 50% category, you had to make $34, pay the government $17 of it to end up with $17. Here, it's a true $17. You're getting a dollar for dollar for your drawings you show up with. The bank says, yes, those are real. The services you're going to do, yes, those are real. So we'll give you dollar for dollar. You don't have to make twice as much to then end up with cash and then pay that through. And then you don't have to pay yourself. You can just walk away from that. And then you don't have to pay tax on that either. So it's an interesting process. And I got to say, I stumbled on all this. I'm not a super smart guy by any means, a genius or what have you. It's just sort of stumbled on this stuff and stumbled on the way that the whole process works with the offsetting depreciation. So I've got an apartment building that makes $100 a year, and there is enough of the building that will actually depreciate $100. So the net result is there's a zero. So you pay no tax. You still get the $100. I don't know any other businesses that are really doing that in that same fact pattern. So it's a very cool thing that architects don't know about that can be capitalized, and you can do really well. We've been very, very fortunate financially with what we've done.
Now, most of your projects are resident, well, some mixed use and residential projects. Right. Does this idea, does the architect as developer idea work in other project types?
You could do, as you were saying, you did tilt-up buildings. You can do tilt-up buildings, out in La Mesa or down in, just south of the, or north of the border. You can do anything you want. I mean, I don't see you doing a hospital. You could. The hospitals, I don't know if they own their buildings or rent them from somebody or what have you. But anything you can do that you can rent out, yeah, you can do this. You got to start to understand the equation. I don't like office buildings per se because I don't quite understand the magic of having a 10,000 square foot space that gets cut up into, let's say, 3.5 people. Oh, sorry, that has to be a whole. That's right. 3 people. Oh, but there's a part left over. What do you do with that? Well, you end up giving that away cheaper, and then one of the persons goes bankrupt or goes out of business. Now you got a 1,500 square foot space in that 10,000 square foot building, but really the market's 1,000 square foot or it's 2,000 foot. It's not the 1,500 foot. Nothing makes sense. I mean, the ultimate product for me would be a concrete box with a window on one end, a skylight on the other to balance the light, and then a drain in the middle. The renters get out of there and you hose it all down, and the next person comes in. It'd be efficient. It would be easily maintained. But the apartment world is now exploding. Not that I knew it was going to happen, but it's exploding as many of the worlds are. But people have to have some place to live, right? So I would focus on the apartments. Plus, the depreciation happens in 27 years on a residential building versus 39 and a half, I think it is, on a commercial building. So your depreciation is a shorter term to offset the income.
Yeah, got it. Mandy, it looks like we've got a question for Mark here.
Yeah, and maybe this is best. I don't know if you actually answered it as you were talking, but Mark wants to know, what are the pros and cons of build and sell versus build and rent?
Okay, so in the state of California, you have something called strict liability, which means that your building effectively has to be perfect. And if it's not perfect, then it's defective. And if it's not defective, well, if it is defective, then someone can sue you to make it perfect. And we have started in San Diego the incubator of the defect litigation that started back in the 70s that's taken over. I think every state probably has it now. But anyway, you have a 10-year statute of limitations. You have to basically keep a perfect building for 10 years, even though you don't own it anymore if you sell it. So we try to keep our buildings for 10 years before we sell them. Obviously, you want to keep them at least a year, or you become a merchant builder, and then you're not in capital gains or in ordinary income. But, you know, we're looking at it now. Our accountant says, hey, you may want to sell another building. I don't want to. I don't think it's the best prudent thing to do, but we may consider it. So I start going through the five buildings that we own. And there's one that's past the 10 years of statute of limitations. My favorite building, so I never want to sell it. But that's the one that if we sold it, we can just walk away. Versus if something's under 10 years, which we have a house that we built in La Jolla that's coming up, that's got like 10 months left. And you just start counting the months. It's crazy. We had a building just trigger past the 10 years in June. It's like there's another one up. So realistically, if you look at all the Jewish boys that have done really well in San Diego, the old guys, they never sell. They sometimes they 1031 exchange into bigger product, but they just don't sell their buildings. I needed to sell in order to raise the capital. So that's why I did that. So I'd sell a building, take the capital, 1031 into another property and build a bigger building. But you get to the point now where like the Q building we have is probably worth $35 million. Where am I going with $35 million to go build another building? That's a lot of money to have to invest in again to do another building. And I just, you know, I'm at the point now I'm trying to kind of wind down, not wind up. So never sell if you can, and don't do a build and sell. That's just problematic, and you're going to get crushed as an architect by a building.
It sounds like a lot of what you're saying isn't as complicated as we think that it might be, but it's more, where's the money and how are you moving the money around and what's the best benefit tax-wise on the money that you're moving around, right? So it's not so much like real estate and the market as much as these decisions are made based on the money, right? And the taxes and...
Well, it's you know, how much do you have? $1 million? Well, $1 million means you can build a $3 million building. You have 10 million means we can build a $30 million building. So you sort of have to figure out how much money you have and how what you want to do. And there's a certain scale at which things make sense. And I think, as I maybe telling you earlier, we have a 23-story building we're doing, and our fee that we're never going to take is $1,350,000 or something that the bank will accept. And then Matthew's doing his, you know, three-story house in Mission Hills that's concrete, that's more complex, and his fee is going to be 75 to 125 grand. Maybe the bank will choke that down. I don't know about that. But there's more work in his house than there is in the high rise because it's duplicative and the floors go up. It's the same plan all the way up. So it's kind of weird. At a certain scale, it doesn't make any sense to do that. But Matthew's house will probably cost him in the low twos and probably worth in the low three. So there's, let's call it a nice even $1 million profit, building your own house, having a great time, being the superintendent. I mean, there's nothing cooler than being out there on a construction site. And, you know, in a year, he'll make $1 million. And then if he holds it for 2 years, then the government said, we'll give you and your wife a $500,000 pass on any taxes whatsoever. So of the million, half of it's tax-free. The other half is capital gains. So effectively, he makes $1 million and he pays, what does he pay? 150 grand in taxes. Whereas if the normal Joe's out there making $1 million, they're paying $500,000. So to get back to this, like there is a very, very, very simple program right there. Go build your own house. And you could do it every 2 years.
Who's your most important or valued consultant?
The demons in my head. Oh, that's about it. I think the accountant's been very helpful. Matt Furman, he's been magic for 30 years. The attorneys are great. Just make sure that, and don't take this as arrogance because it isn't, but just assume you're smarter than them, because everything is really basic, general math, practical, common sense. The attorneys tend to overcomplicate stuff. I tend to want to get stuff into mediation to clarify and get things behind me. They tend to want to litigate, like these couple of instances I talked about. Oh yeah, we'll crush them in court. Sure we will. I'll lose two years of my life being stressed out, and you'll make a bunch of money, and I'll lose a bunch of money. The most important consultant is your own brain and what you're doing, and talking to yourself a lot. And I tend to do that a lot. Talk to myself, not in public, but and try and manage, my expectations of where I'm going. I set up every year. I have a 3-year, 2-year, and a 1-year goal, personally, financially, and architecturally. And it's strange. Sometimes you just put these kind of crazy things out there and they happen. Things have happened quicker than I thought, and faster and better. And some things have been not so much. But you got to be, again, not to be trying to be arrogant, you got to be confident in what you're doing. You don't have to be cocky about it, but you have to have confidence in yourself. And the first time you start questioning anything, you're done. I never look back. I never double question what a decision I make. I make the decision and I move forward. And if you start to go, whoa, then we'll overanalyze something, you'll just kill yourself. There's a lot of big decisions you have to make, and you got to be able to take good information. I've had shitty information. I've made bad decisions on shitty information. You didn't tell me about this. You didn't tell me about that. Ask questions. There are no questions that are stupid. The only stupid if you ask them twice and you don't hear it the first time. People may think you're a little stupid. Oh, I don't understand this. Can you explain it to me? Well, guess what? Now you understand it. And it's all basic stuff. And all you have to do is make basic decision off that.
I know you have, I know you have the Architect as Developer courses, but on a broader scale, should what we're talking about right now, everything that you've learned over, you've been at this since the row houses in the very beginning. So you've learned a lot, obviously, over the 30 years or whatever it's been,
yeah.
33 years. Should this be part of architectural education, what we're talking about right now?
Well, as Bandy was saying, I was just on a discussion panel with the AIA of California, and they're trying to have a group to actually change education. And I think, as I said, if 3% of all architects are designers, why are 100% of the architectural students using a third of their entire college education to learn design? It doesn't make any sense. Why? I remember the teacher, they almost found it like comedy to beat up on the poor guys or ladies that couldn't design at all. Well, why are you putting them through that? That's just stupid. It's almost... That's arrogant. That's cruel. That's arrogant. That's badgering people. That's being bullies. If you don't want to be a designer, but you want to reinvent how sheet metal is put together, go for it. And let's focus on that. Let's give you all the runway you need. We need to calm down from 5 years to 4 years. We need to teach people how to do development. You teach pro practice. My pro practice class was worthless. Completely worthless. It was a 3-credit class. Why can't you just take my little book that I, when you do my thing, you get a book. Take that book, read through the whole thing, and practice and apply something. Learn some stuff. Learn the contracts that are in there. Learn real life stuff, and have architects not take any more learning credits, but have the architects have to teach 2 hours a year. That's their learning credits. They can teach others. There's a better way to do all this stuff. But then architecture as common practice may still be one avenue to get something done. I still think long-term you're going to see the architecture profession become a larger set of bag boys. If I was a person, as a business person out there, and I had a company that made microchips and I wanted to get a microchip factory together, I would hire a contractor and I would tell that contractor to put the architect under his umbrella. Because I don't want this. I don't want that bad triangle. I want someone to take responsibility for it. And I think that's the way stuff's going. I mean, you guys can tell me. I don't do any fee work for anybody. I have no interest in it. Not when I can do a house like Matthew's going to do and there's $1 million profit versus a $50,000 or $75,000 fee, of which, you know, I'm going to put twice the amount of work in it. But it's all good news.
Yeah. I think, you know, we talk about this a lot in the community, and we'll be having a lot of just based on our guests coming up on Context and Clarity Live, I can see we're headed towards a lot of conversations about the future of architectural education and future of practice. And so it always energizes me to have conversations like this where, you know, this, is it a different practice model? Absolutely. Does it make sense? As you said, I think it does actually. So, yeah, I'm interested to hear what other people in the audience have to say about that. But I appreciate the approach that you're talking about. I know we're kind of headed towards the top of the hour here, so I'd be remiss at not asking about your car collection.
let me give you one thought, and then we'll move into the cars.
Okay,
because that's a pretty important part of my world. We as a profession, I believe, are the best profession there is. I think the architects care more than everybody. They do more than everybody. They want to do better. So the good news for me is there's no way I could have had the impact on our city that I did unless I did it the way I did it. We couldn't have been creating all the prototypes. Every building was a prototype. It was a new idea, new type, this, you know, idea here and here and here. Because I would have had to answer to somebody else. Architecturally, schematically, diagrammatically, we were able to do what we want. We had the word control. We controlled everything. Now, was it brutal? Yeah. Did it work out? Yes, we're very fortunate. But at some point in your life, you know, having $1 million in the bank or $100 million or $1 billion in the bank is meaningless if you have no legacy and something to actually physically look back on and what you did. We just got a wonderful award from the state of California that there's no way creating regular architecture I would ever receive that award. But the fact that we were able to do what we are do and continue doing what we do, nobody in their right mind, we're doing a 50 foot by 100 foot, 23 story high rise that's glued to another building that we own. Where the two buildings meet, there's a property line because I put an easement on the building I own that stops it at 8 stories. From then on, I can have glass. No one's doing this. That's a lot of brain damage. But for us, financially, there's a benefit. But architecturally, there's a benefit. And there's a prototype that's been done. And there's a legacy that'll be there. There's a lot of really ugly, bad buildings that are going up in our city. And I think most cities, if you look at most cities, all these buildings look very similar. It's kind of amazing how it's not helping our city. But I can say, you know, sincerely that there are a lot of people that are very happy with what we've done for our city. But moving on to the cars, we currently have 15 cars. We specialize in one genre, let's call it 50s European Italian cars. We have 3 Maseratis. We have one that's, they're all called, okay, A6G is the actual model. They made 60 of them. In 1956, and we have the most important existing all-original one that we bought in Paris 5 years ago, and we have the most important convertible one, and we have the most important Zagato design coupe, so that's the focus of that. We also have an Alfa Romeo that we just restored that we just took to Europe. We have a Lancia that we're getting ready to go to the Pebble Beach with, and then I have 3 Corvettes because I like American cars, 3 Porsches because I like Porsche cars, and we keep them in a place we call the Batcave, which was put underneath our building. So we built the building, and we had the land for free, and we just built another story below, and an elevator takes it down, and that then is where we keep the cars. We rent from ourselves, and then because we rented, you could monetize that and get a value that goes back in the building. We basically borrowed all the money out that we put in. And so now you can ask your question about the cars.
this is the chicken and the egg, but maybe it's the car and the developer question.
Okay.
If it weren't for the developments, would there be the cars?
Not a chance. We've been fortunate. We've made a lot of money on the cars too. But I think all the tides, the tides are raising all the boats at that point. But no, there we have a substantial amount of funds in cars that there's no way I would have ever had that. And the good news is, as I'm talking about these goals, I had the goal of collecting this one Zagato Maserati, which they made 18 of them, 61 total. 18 were designed by Zagato, the design house. And this is the last car ever made of that lineage. So it was the most refined. And it's certainly, without a doubt, the most important car I think I'll ever own in my life. It's stunning. It's beautiful. Got runner-up the best show at Pebble Beach this year. It drives like crazy. It's a race car with a regular coupe top on it. And it's fun. It's like another world. There's subcontractors out there. There's wonderful ones. There's bad ones. I've made a lot of friends. We just came back from London. We came back from Como, Italy, at two different concours with the cars. And it's very akin to architecture. These things are designed by design houses, like architecture design houses. And they're beautiful. And when you take them apart to restore them, you learn about all these intricacies that happen. And it's a wonderful, wonderful hobby to have, shall we say.
So did the cars inform your architecture in any way?
Yeah, big time. When we look at the building, the Polk, I think it was just published on Architizer. If you really study the front of that thing, it's basically a big Rolls-Royce grill with the fins in the front. And I can't believe they built those fins so perfectly. There's a lot of metaphors. The Continental name came from Lincoln Continental, and a Mercury from 57 had these little, the grill basically had a series of little, like I'm going to call them squares, that were on there that were a pattern. And the squares were something I took as the imagery for making these affordable micro housing projects. And then each balcony then was a square, but the square was then made into a delta, which is a big 50s move on European and American cars. And so they have these kind of delta pieces to them. So all this stuff, proportions, rhythm, all that stuff comes back and forth between the cars and the architecture. That helps us do what we do.
Yeah. Well, it's a great metaphor that ties back to the Batcave that you've built.
Yes.
I mean, you sort of glossed over that. I don't know if everybody caught that or not, but you're talking about the Batcave and how it was built and paid for and pays for itself and everything else. And it seems to me we've had this conversation, and you mentioned control. You said control a couple of minutes
ago.
And I think I heard you say this in an interview a while back. You were talking about building within your rights, I think is how you said it. So basically, we're not taking input from the neighborhood group.
No, thank you.
We're not doing zoning variances or anything like that. And can you talk about that for a minute? Because I really want the audience to hear you say this for everybody out there that's an architect that has complained about the neighborhood group or the presentation to the city here in Indianapolis, it's the city county council or whatever it is. Can you talk about that control and building within your rights for a second?
Yeah, the worst thing is when you have a homeowners group or community group tell you what to do. It's like, are you kidding me? You don't go to a doctor who's going to perform, heart surgery on there and have a group of your buddies just hang out and have him make a presentation and then critique how he's going to do it. I've had groups way back when that would say, your buildings look like a prison and there's no glass in it. And, I'm not sure, a police station, just like horrible things. You would never want anybody to ever say to you about your work. And you just have to sit there and just eat shit in front of them. It's like, no, this is wrong. this is my property and I should have the right to do. So we've always, except for right now with this high rise, because of the historic house on it, focused on properties that fell under the radar that had no community input whatsoever. And it's crazy because when you start construction, they go, whoa, what just happened here? Why is this guy ahead of us? We didn't even know about it. And they get all twisted up and crazy. And it's just, I have no interest in that. You know, I'm too busy trying to do what I do to hear a bunch of crybabies telling me they want, you know, a pink building or a green building, or they want tile roof, or they want, I don't care what they want. If they want that, then go build your own stuff. Because, I mean, I think most architects can't even read their own plans. How is a community group person think they can actually read some plans? We just made a presentation last night. I won't get into it. And they were just ecstatic over the changes that we had made to the project, making it better. And I said, well, Matthew, what was that? He goes, I don't know, because we didn't change anything. But they were ecstatic, and they were like 100% out behind it. And it's like, well, it's the same project we brought before. And but anyway, back to control, back to ideas, back to goals. My goal would be to make a cathedral one day. That would be a wonderful project I'd like to do. How can I do that? Well, I was looking at some Quonset huts that my friend Marlon Brown, Blackwell was working on in, I think it's Detroit, for a developer, like little bitty ones. I'm like, those are kind of cool. Then I looked up those prototypes and, man, there's some really cool ones that are like 50 feet wide and they're maybe 100 feet deep, and they put them on top of these containers to get them off the ground, and they store hay under. I'm like, wow, that looks like pretty cheap. So I found out a 50 by 100 vault, that's a culvert, like vault looking thing, is $65,000 for the material. Then you put it together. I'm like, holy shit, that's cheap. So now what I want to do is I want to get my bat cave out of the ground. I'm going to go build a new Johnny Club, and I'm going to have this beautiful vault that's all silver, that's made in Iowa or whatever, and shipped out here. And we're going to have my cathedral. We'll have the big church space. It's 35 feet high and 50 feet wide, and it's going to be up on concrete block plinths that will be little spaces and little nooks off the side. So I think you can get to where you want to and do almost any type of building type if you just sort of reconsider how you're doing it.
I love it. So what's it a cathedral to? I mean, is it a cathedral or is it a cathedral
for cars? For cars? Yeah, for my car. Just got to get it going, you know, and then I don't know how the heck I'm going to put it together. You put it together with like these bolts and all the pieces just bolt together. They're about 21 inches wide and they have about a 7-inch deviation up and down. And they're made out of 22 gauge metal. It's crazy. They span 100 feet or 50 feet. Anyway, stay tuned for that.
We've got to hook you up with Earl Parsons, who's part of this community.
Okay.
He's building a Quonset hut community, I think on the north edge of the Grand Canyon, somewhere in that area.
Crazy.
He specializes in Quonset hut construction for residential projects.
So, nice. That'd be fabulous. I just don't know how I'm going to put that together. They show you sort of
Earl can tell you
on the ground and tilting it up, and it's all flimsy and stuff. So
yeah. Earl, yeah, we'll hook you up. Earl will tell you. I saw a comment a minute ago, or a question a minute ago, that somebody wants to know. We were talking about the cars. What's your daily driver? It's probably not one of the Maseratis.
I drive all my cars. Today I have my Alfa Romeo 1964 TZ1 out, which is possibly my funnest car I have. They made 105 of them. There's about 30 real ones left. It's a 1,400-pound car. Zagato designed it, and it's got 165 horsepower. But I drive Porsches. I have a turbo convertible Porsche that I drive every day. My wife drives a Tesla.
Nice. What's the next car you're going to buy?
I just drove a 1931 Alfa Romeo 1750 that's supercharged. That was pretty crazy. So I think at some point I'm going to morph into trying to get, it's called a 6C, six cylinder, 1750. They make a 6C 2300. Then they make an 8C, which is the most coveted car in the world, 2.9 liter. These cars just rip. It's amazing. They're better than modern cars built in the 30s. So, you know, everything evolves, right? You start with seven units and you build a high rise. There's an evolution. You start with, my first car was a 356. I still have it, a 1959 sunroof coupe. And you start to evolve and you go up and down, and you start to get to a resolution where you start to understand cars and why they are, what they are. What's the race heritage? What's the ownership heritage? Why were they right for this and that? And it's very cool. I have an Instagram account you guys can look at that has a lot of the cars in there. My Alpha's in there that we just did really well with at Pebble Beach and also Como and Hampton Court.
I love the parallels. Everything is tied together here in this entire in your entire experience. So I appreciate all of that. One last question, then we're going to have to wrap this up because we're at the top of the hour. But for anybody that's here in the audience that has been listening to us and is finally ready to take the leap to become an architect and a developer, what's the one thing that they absolutely have to do today in order to get that ball rolling?
I'm not here to try and sell my seminar, but if I don't know what it is, $600 or something, there's probably $35,000 worth of legal documents in there. If you can get that and just, it's 8 hours, you get actually 8 hours of learning credits through it. I think that'll give you the foundation to understand the ABCs of what I do. Always build in your neighborhood because you know it. Like, you know, where I'm going to go build a house 30 miles away. And no. Build it within a mile of where you live. So you understand the product, you understand the neighborhood, you understand the program, build your house and then build apartments. And you will be looking back one day when you've got all these apartments that are now punching out real money and giving you rent. And, you know, property management's the worst job you could ever have, but you sort of have to manage your own stuff too. Again, you need to control everything. There's that word again. Do everything yourself. You'll be more proud of it. There'll be more satisfaction. And when you're done, you know, you only have one person to blame, that's yourself. Or one person to pat on the back, that's yourself. And it's very gratifying. There's nothing like seeing one of our models become three-dimensional. It's cool. And if you think about it, you know, I was listening to Richard Serra talk about, oh yeah, I've got a $17 million sculpture he's building. Well, we built this project over here, a $30 million eight-story building. That's a big sculpture. It's in the city. It's there for everybody, right? It's there forever. And our architects, we do that. We build cities. We make them better. And anything you can do to improve the life of another person is a real positive.
Thanks for listening to this week's Context and Clarity Live episode. Selfishly, I love these conversations because I get to be the go-between between you and some really incredible guests. To that end, I want to know what you think about today's guest. Message me on the socials. I'm really easy to find. I'm Jeff_Eccles everywhere. If you happen to run across a white-haired chiropractor from Austin, Texas, yeah, that's not me. I'm the other Jeff Eccles. Oh, and if you have an idea for a future guest, tell me who it is and why you think they'd be a good guest for one of these conversations. Maybe we can get them on a future episode. All right. If you want more of the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you, subscribe wherever you consume podcasts. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's the multimedia network for people that care about the built environment, and it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know you'll find something there that interests you. You can learn more at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community and your practice and how you can support those around you. I'll be back here again tomorrow. And in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entree Architect community on Facebook. The link is entrearchitect.com/group. That's where every weekday at 4 p.m. I host Context and Clarity Conversations.
And we take these topics, the topics that you hear about in this daily podcast episode, and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time so we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context is.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.